Listen to the highly anticipated 100th episode of Tank and Jay Valentine's R&B Money Podcast with artist Chris Brown.
Even working with you from Carrie Hilson, Adonis, back in the day, I was 15, 14 doing that album. So like I said, I was in school like, okay, this is how you do it. This is how you make a song. There's a verse, a pre-chorus, and then a hook. I didn't know none of that.
You learned that over a summer, bro.
That's what it felt like.
That's what it felt like.
Listen to R&B Money on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, this is Justin Richmond, host of the Broken Record Podcast. Join me along with co-host Leah Rose as we sit down with the artists you love to get unparalleled creative insight. You'll hear revealing interviews with some of the most legendary figures in music like Paul Simon, Usher, Pete Townsend, Damon Albarn of the Gorillaz, and Missy Elliott. And you'll hear from up-and-comers like jazz artist Leve, who told me about her fast rise to fame during the pandemic. Listen to Broken Record on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Check the backseat. Check the backseat.
All right, come here.
Check the backseat.
Gets in your head, right? Good. Because every year, dozens of children are forgotten in the backseat of a car by a parent or caregiver. All never thought it could happen to them. But with changes in routines, distractions, or a sleeping child, it can happen to anyone. Parked cars get hot, fast, and can be deadly. So get it in your head.
Check the backseat.
A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Inside the Studio on iHeartRadio. My name's Jordan Runtog, but enough about me. It's hard to know where to start with my guest today. She began her 60-year career as a folk singer, honing her craft in the Greenwich Village clubs that fostered the likes of Arlo Guthrie and Bob Dylan in the early 60s. Since then, she's become one of the most beloved interpreters of popular song, elevating early compositions by Leonard Cohen and Joni Mitchell into era-defining classics. A brilliant songwriter in her own right, she's used her one-of-a-kind voice to champion social causes and the endurance of the human spirit. Now she's using her voice in a different way, as a podcast host. This summer, she's launched a new bi-weekly interview series entitled Since You've Asked. The show finds her deep in conversation with an array of fascinating friends, including Clive Davis, actor Jeff Daniels, Christiane Amanpour, and many others. She's likened their chats to virtual dinner dates, which allowed her to keep social in the age of COVID. The podcast is far from her only pandemic project. Earlier this year, she restaged her legendary 1964 concert at New York's Town Hall, the show that helped launch her career. This time around, she played nearly the same selection of songs, with her voice as strong as ever. But one major difference was that the theater was empty. The audience tuned in via live stream. A live album of the performance will be released on August 27th. It'll follow her latest musical offering, White Bird, an anthology of her favorite recordings, bolstered with a few revamped reimaginings of some of her classics. And she's also hard at work on a new album of original material as well. Suffice it to say, she's probably significantly busier than you are, and as such, I'm extra grateful for her time. I'm so thrilled to welcome Ms. Judy Collins.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
I have so many things I want to talk to you about, but I wanted to start with your amazing new podcast, Since You've Asked. It's such a wonderful project to do in the midst of lockdown. I think you've said it's almost like a dinner date or a dinner party, and that really comes across. How did this start for you?
Well, first of all, I love the Zoom potential, and I use it all the time. You know, in New York, my husband and I live here, and of course, the lockdown started, and we have a social life. We have dinner with friends a few times a month. So we just continued that without the dinner. We had podcasts with friends, and that has been going on and still going on. Because now there are some people who have kind of been out of the city, so we do the podcast with them. Or if they've decided to venture out, we'll go to dinner with them. So that very much has been, my social life is very important to me. I believe in the healing and intellectually stimulating contents of discussions with friends. I think it's part of the stuff of life, and if you are denied it, you can wither, you know, on the vine. So that was going on, and I think my manager and I were talking one day, and she said, "Why don't you do that with some people that you can have a longer conversation with?" So we decided to start doing the podcast, which I just love it. I think it's a privilege to be able to peer into somebody's life in a more, for instance, I won't break this open entirely, but I did do a show, a podcast with my old friend, Clive Davis. And one of the nice things is that I'm not a client. I'm a friend. I've known him for almost 60 years now. And so there's a way to talk to somebody that's different than if you're a client. And on the other hand, then my own, the head of my label, Jack Holzman, whom I've known for 60 years too, and he's a very close friend, and I am his guy, was his client, and I Elektra Records, you know, started my life and so on. So I know a lot about him and he about me. So it's a different kind of thing in both cases, but both satisfying, interesting, educational, and a lot of fun.
I was going to ask you about the Jack Holzman interviews, one I'm really excited to hear, just because, as you said, you do go back such a long way, and he had such a big role in your life and your career.
Yeah, incredible role, incredible role.
Tell me more about some of your guests. So far, on the ones that are out now, we've heard Jeff Daniels and Julia Cameron. Who else do we have in there? I think Arlo Guthrie, I think, is one of them.
Arlo's coming along, and Arlo and I, of course, I met Arlo when I first did my first New York show. It was 1961, and I was, you know, in the old days, it's the old days. When I started in 1959, my first job was in Boulder, Colorado, at a place called Michael's Pub, and it was a pizza and parlor, and kind of a class, you know, upper echelon pizza parlor from Tulagi's and The Sink, which were two of the real places where you just get down and dirty drunk. And Michael's Pub was a step up, and he had music. He had barbershop quartets and accordion players. And then I had been asked by my husband why I didn't get a job doing something I knew how to do, because I was doing a very bad job at filing papers at the University of Colorado. And so my father got me an interview, an audition at Michael's Pub. This was sort of out of the blue. Nobody knew that you could make a living singing folk songs. I mean, there was no entrance to that. My father was a big star in the radio business, but he sang Rodgers and Hart and had a great radio show. And I mean, that was a whole other era of music. And so folk music was ridiculous. Forget it. But I went down and I had an audition. I played and sang a concert for an hour, and he hired me. And so that was the start. And in those days, it was very much word of mouth. One person, he would call the place in, I'm sure he called the Gilded Garter in Central City and said, you know, she sold some tickets, and why don't you try her? So I went up. That was my second date, you know. And then I went to the Exodus in Denver and in between. And then in about 2 years' time, after working all these clubs, word of mouth, I got to New York, and I was actually the headliner. I couldn't believe it. I'd only been doing it a couple of years. But I got there, and I found out that my opener was a 13-year-old named Arlo Guthrie. So that's when we met. And he was always so darling and charming. I knew his mother very well because my manager, quite quickly, became Harold Levinthal, who managed the Weavers, and Pete Seeger, and Alan Arkin, and Theodore Bacall. He managed, it seemed to me, almost everybody who made records, who made music that was folk music. And Harry Belafonte always wanted Harold to manage him, but he had told me that he consistently said no. I don't know why he said no. That would have been a lot of fun. So I have known Arlo all these years, and we've done all kinds of things. We went to Japan together in 1966 with Mimi and Bruce Langhorne, and we had a great time there. And I sang at Arlo's wedding to Jackie, his wonderful, wonderful wife. I loved Jackie. She was a treasure, and unfortunately she died a couple of years ago. And Arlo has been just a mainstay in my life. We've done shows together. We've traveled together. We have in common so many friends. So this past 2 years ago, we started working on let's do a big tour together. And so it took a while, but finally we must have had 50, 75 shows, places like Ravinia and Tanglewood and, you know, the big places, of course, Humphreys out in the West and a lot of places. And they were all set up. And then, of course, the pandemic hit, and he called me in September. We had all these dates none of them were canceled. They were just moved into the next and then the next and then the next month. And he said, I have to tell you this because I don't want to tell anybody yet until I've told you that I'm retiring. I can't do this anymore because I've had a couple of heart attacks and I just don't have the stamina and I can't sing very well and so on. And I said, well, you have to think about your health. So he said, yes, I do. And I said, I'm concerned about your health, but I think the best thing for you to do is to not go out anymore and do this touring that we do, which is, you have no idea how hard it is. Nobody doesn't do it has any idea how hard it is. But I said, meantime, why don't we do a talk together? I hadn't even come up with the podcast idea yet, but I said we should do one of these talks. I did a talk for Carnegie Hall, did a series of interviewing other people, and I interviewed my friend Jimmy Webb and Alan Cumming and Sean Colvin and Steve Earle, and we all four of us talked together on a Zoom show for Carnegie Hall. We did it probably in, I would say June or July last summer. You can get it on their podcast if you go on to Carnegie Hall and you look it up. And the Carnegie Hall president, wonderful man, introduced me. And it was, he said, he was introducing me and he said, and Judy Collins has done 50 shows over the years at Carnegie Hall. I hadn't known what the number was. I knew it was an awful lot because most of those early years, I sang every year at Christmas, which Arlo did. Arlo sang at Thanksgiving, and I sang at Christmas. And it was pretty much the New York routine. You know, people would go to both of our shows. So we had a good time. Anyway, we had a just fabulous time with our podcast. So that'll be coming down in the series very soon.
Oh, I can't wait to hear. I mean, with these people that you have had these deep relationships with for many, many years, the Arlos, the Jack Holtzmans, the Clive Davises, did you find when you were doing these podcasts that you learned stuff about them that you never knew?
Oh, yes. I won't spill the beans again, but I asked Clive in the middle of the podcast, and it's revealed, you find out things. I mean, I found out how he got into this business. It wasn't through a musical connection. It was legal. You know, he went to law school and was with a firm, and they wanted him to go to Monterey and represent some client down there. I don't even know who it was. And he was mesmerized and transformed by listening to Janis Joplin and Santana. That's how he got into it. I didn't know that. And I said to him during the show, I said, who was the one who got away? And he said, you know, that's a great question. I've never been asked that question. People ask me who I dropped and who walked away from me, but no one ever asked me who got away. And you know, it was a big surprise. You want to know who it was? It was Harry Chapin. He said, your guy overbid me. Jack Holtzman wrote a bigger check.
Was he on Elektra?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So that was funny.
Oh, that's right. Taxi was on Elektra. Yeah.
And of course, you do find out things. People tell you things that they would not necessarily say in public, or if it was scripted, they would not say. And they're at home, you know. They're not in a studio. The lights are not shining on them, so they're in their living rooms, or maybe in their bedrooms, and maybe in their dining rooms. But you're intimately talking with them in a way that is very free form. I'm sure you find that. You've done so many of these. And you understand that people are going in various directions, and sometimes they're a surprise.
It's such an incredible privilege and such an incredible way to engage your sense of curiosity, to learn about all sorts of different people and all sorts of different ideas. Do you find that you learn something about yourself having done this?
I learn a lot about my own curiosity, absolutely. And also that I'm really, I'll talk about anything. You pry open those little doors and you just never know what's going to come out, really. And it's a good thing because conversation is how we grow and learn, and it gives us a balanced life, and it gives us an idea of how the other side is living, you know, and what things can be troublesome and what things are a lot of fun. And it's conversation. Now, I grew up in this kind of family because my dad was in the radio business, so his radio show consisted of his playing and singing the songs of the Great American Songbook, and telling about his life and reading poetry and having guests. He had a lot of guests on his show. Some of them would come home to dinner. George Shearing came to dinner and said, I think you should continue practicing the piano, Mozart, instead of playing those folk songs. That's what he said to me. I never forgot it.
Hey, this is Justin Richmond, host of the Broken Record Podcast. Join me and co-host Leah Rose for in-depth creative conversations with the artists you love. Over the past 5 years, we've interviewed some of the most legendary figures in music, like Paul Simon, Pharrell, Damon Albarn, Andre 3000, and Usher. And you'll hear from rock icons like Pete Townsend, who shares wild stories about his formative years with The Who, and Johnny Marr, the legendary guitarist and co-founder of The Smiths, who has an unwavering devotion to his craft. Or the stories behind the legendary hits Babyface wrote for Whitney Houston and Madonna, plus how he collaborates with the new generation of R&B stars like Kehlani and Doechii. Listen to Broken Record on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My simple solution to the problem was remove people from the scene and help them feel safer.
In response to attacks against Asian Americans, Maddie Park raised over $250,000 to donate cab rides to the Asian community.
There is so much more work to be done. We really need to come together and tackle this issue as a community.
Support the Asian community. Learn how at lovehasnolabels.com. Brought to you by Love Has No Labels and the Ad Council.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
It sounds like music was just in your DNA. Was it always something that you knew this is what you'd be devoting your life to? Or was there a moment when there was a lightning bolt moment?
Well, I knew that I would be doing it, and I did it the whole time I was growing up. I always had music in my life, and I was playing the piano. I was singing in the choirs as a kid. My teachers were wonderful. You know, I started music lessons in, we moved to L.A. in 1944, probably, and my parents immediately got me a piano teacher, and I used to, in those days, you know, I got on a bus at 5 years old with my music under my arm and got on the bus and went to Santa Monica from West L.A. to have my lessons. I mean, life was very safe. Kids were very safe. People in general, it seemed to me. Of course, now we know that it wasn't so safe for a lot of people. And there were a lot of things going on that were so horrible that when the 60s finally rolled around, I think what was most appealing about the 60s was that we finally realized how much we'd been lied to and how much we are lied to, and determined that we would try to find the truth. But yes, talking and the kind of interviews my dad did were very much a part of our lives, and then we would all talk together about things around the table. That's where our political education came in, I think.
I look back and think about all the dinner table conversations that we had as a family growing up and how much they shaped me. And I realized that, you know, you take them for granted at the time because you just want to finish your dinner and go off to whatever you're doing and go play. But it's amazing what you learn from those.
Yeah. Play ball.
I have to say, the show has such a perfect title, Since You've Asked, which, for anyone who doesn't know, is a track off of your album, Wildflowers. And I think it's the first song you ever wrote, right?
It's the first song. And that's how they get you. You know, they get you. I sat down after Leonard Cohen asked me why I wasn't writing my own songs. I came home, I sat down at my Steinway, because I'd been practicing for the various songs that were going on that album in my life. I just wrote it. It took me 40 minutes, and that was done. And it hasn't ever been the same since. I mean, it never takes 40 minutes anymore. The next one took about 5 years. But I was hooked. And so Since You've Asked, right now, I'm trying to write a song for my granddaughter's wedding, which is happening in a few weeks in California. And, you know, I thought, because a lot of people tell me they sing Since You've Asked at their weddings, all of their weddings, not just the first one. And I thought, well, I can't do that. I have to write. I've written songs for my own wedding, for my brother Denver's wedding, for my brother Dave's wedding for an old friend who wasn't even a relative. So I have to write an original song for her. I mean, there's no question. Take my hand with your own. We can solve the broken world together. That's the start of what I'm writing, but who knows what'll happen, because I don't know. I have to work at it every day and try to write something different every day so that I can figure out what's going to make it to the wedding.
That's just amazing. I mean, I hear Since You've Asked Now, and I know, knowing that it was your first song, I'm thinking, I'm somebody who's loved music my whole life, and as hard as I try, I've never been able to write a song ever. I love it with all my heart. I dabble in different instruments, but it's not in me. I can't imagine starting from scratch as you did and writing something as beautiful and sophisticated and as timeless as that song. I guess my question is, what are your tips for someone like me who's sort of struggling with how to start writing music?
Don't do it. It'll break your heart. Sheer sweat. And it's a job. I have a friend who writes mysteries who says, you know, writing is like laying pipe. It's, you have to go at it every day. Well, I'm just coming out in, I think this week, Wednesday or Thursday, I'm going out into the studio to do some more final vocals on my most recent album, which is an album of all my own songs called Spellbound, and it'll come out in February, I think, of 22. And it's in part, it's some songs that I finished and or started and finished in the pandemic, and some that I was finishing up in 2029. And but I have to work very, very, very hard at it. And I'm not sure that anything is as good as, oh, I know, The Blizzard is pretty good. The Blizzard, I think, and Since You've Asked, are probably my best songs. The Blizzard has to be kept in good shape because a lot of my songwriting friends love it, and I have to be ready to play it at the drop of a hat. And I think actually that the next thing is to get a movie filmed with the song as a context for the movie. So that's something I need to pay some attention to, because it is a great story. It's sort of my equivalent of The Gambler.
I have to say, I loved your song Dreamers. It is an amazing, for anyone who hasn't heard it, it is this absolutely exquisite a cappella piece inspired by the immigration crisis, I suppose, is the most simplest way to phrase it. But can you tell me a little more about that song? It is breathtaking.
I was sitting here at the kitchen, at the dining room table one day, and my husband and I were watching a conversation on television with a young woman who, she said, and I quoted her, "My name is Maria. My daughter is a dreamer. She says that she's worried that she will have to leave." And that's the first line of the song. And I went into the studio and I wrote it down. And I started playing it immediately. And I worked on it for about 4 years, 2016, 17, 18, maybe two, maybe nine. No, it was 2 years. Anyway, I was playing the piano and playing it and playing it. And we were in Seattle, and I was working at a club called Ash Alley, and my husband was out there with me. And he said, you know, you really have to mix up your set. You really need some new songs. Why don't you sing that new song you're writing? And I said, well, I haven't figured out how to play it at the piano. He said, don't play it at the piano, just sing it. Just sing it acapulco, as we say. And so I did, and I sang it, and my name it is Maria, my daughter is a dreamer. She says that she is worried that she will have to leave. And when I finished the song, there was this silence that came over the audience. It was stunning. Nobody moved. Nobody said a word. Nobody clapped. Nobody. There's just this absolute. And then they all went crazy. And they kept doing that every time I sang it. Because I'm convinced that when people are in an environment where there's live music going on, they're going through a lot of things in their mind that have to do with kind of shifting their point of view and examining what's going on in their lives and making choices that have nothing to do, very often have nothing to do with what's really happening, but it's something that's transforming because of the live music. I think that's what live music does. It gets to the brain in a subtle way and does the kind of work that, well, we like to think that teaching always does that, but it doesn't always do it. But music quite often does it. It's the silence. It's people sitting in an auditorium that's hushed, where they're not on their devices, and where no one is coming up and slapping them on the backs and saying, you want a drink? But they're kind of hostage to the artist on stage. I like to think of it that way.
What is it about music that you think makes it such a potent medium for transmitting emotion and enacting change?
It's probably essential to human survival. I think it was probably... Well, first of all, it's essential to have a voice because you have to be able to scream while running in the forest chasing some prey that you're going to have for dinner. Or if you get injured by some animal that you're chasing, you have to be able to scream so that somebody comes after you. So the voice is always important, and it carries wisdom. You know, the whales have the music of their songs to contain and transmit information. That's what I hear from Roger Payne, who's the person who played me the first recordings of the singing of the humpback whales many years ago. And apparently they have information about what the best way to go to the breeding grounds is, and you know whose tanker is nearby that you might not want to run into on the way to Alaska or something. So I'm sure it's got all kinds of information, and we carry information in our DNA, which we can transmit with songs, with words. And now we know that people who have a... You may not know this about this wonderful man, but I traveled and recorded for a wonderful singer named Eric Weisberg for years and years. He was really part of my origins, and we did a lot of traveling. He even went to Soviet Union with me in 1965. So I've known him for years, and he's a fantastic banjo player. He was very famous. And towards the end of his life, he really had Alzheimer's. He was not communicating. And so a bunch of his buddies, old pickin' buddies, you know, went up to where he lived and began to sing and play. And he picked up the guitar and he played and sang with them. So it has a magical ability to transcend the physical incapacity of the brain, because it'll wake the brain up with memory. And music is the thing that's been said to help many, many people find their way through, not necessarily back, but certainly through the temporarily to wake the brain up to things that it knew before. Particularly poetry and song, which tell part of our history.
Hey, this is Justin Richmond, host of the Broken Record Podcast. Join me and co-host Leah Rose for in-depth creative conversations with the artists you love. Over the past 5 years, we've interviewed some of the most legendary figures in music, like Paul Simon, Pharrell, Damon Albarn, Andre 3000, and Usher. And you'll hear from rock icons like Pete Townsend, who shares wild stories about his formative years with The Who, and Johnny Marr, the legendary guitarist and co-founder of The Smiths, who has an unwavering devotion to his craft. Or the stories behind the legendary hits Babyface wrote for Whitney Houston and Madonna, plus how he collaborates with the new generation of R&B stars like Kehlani and Doechii. Listen to Broken Record on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Check the backseat. Check the backseat.
All right, come here.
Check the backseat.
Gets in your head, right? Good. Because every year, dozens of children are forgotten in the backseat of a car by a parent or caregiver. All never thought it could happen to them. But with changes in routines, distractions, or a sleeping child, it can happen to anyone. Parked cars get hot, fast, and can be deadly. So get it in your head.
Check the backseat.
A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing. This week, I'm talking to acclaimed musician and entrepreneur, Mr. Worldwide himself, Pitbull.
A lot of artists in general, people that are very creative, sometimes tend to overthink. That's one of my number one rules. Don't ever overthink. You can think ahead, but don't overthink. And what I mean by that is when they start to write a record, they're like, oh, that's not the line. oh, that's not this, oh, it's not that. And everybody has a creative process. I'm not knocking it. For me, I just let it flow.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I mean, you've used your musical voice for so much good and to try to enact change for so many years. Who are the people who, I think we called them Eskimos in my family, the people who guided you to teach you and show you to use these songs for good and to use your platform for to try to make a difference? Who are some people who taught you that?
Well, I fell into that community immediately because when I was 15 and jumped off of the classical piano route, and decided I had to have a guitar because I had heard the Gypsy Rover and Barbara Allen on the radio, and I decided they were songs I had to sing. And that's when I started going to Wells Music in Denver, and I was told by the guy who ran the shop, you know, he said, this is, you've ordered a pair of folk songs here, and this is what folk music is all around me. And then he showed me all these albums of Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie and Cynthia Gooding and the Clancy Brothers and Burl Ives and so on. And it was the folk music world that I became a part of. And I joined because I moved to New York and because Harold Leventhal said yes, he would manage me, which was a great blessing. And I walked into his office on 57th Street in 1963, and Pete Seeger was lying on behind the couch, sound asleep, with his banjo stretched out beside him. And so I fell right into the club. And so this was what people were doing, and this is what I loved. I loved these songs. When I was 16 or so, 17 maybe, I was at a folk music gathering on Lookout Mountain, and a young singer named Mart Hoffman sang me a Woody Guthrie song called Deportees. And Deportees is probably, I mean, essentially what I was writing about when I was writing Dreamers years later, but probably with that as my incentive. The thing about that was that I loved Mart Hoffman. He was so sweet, so wonderful, such a great singer. And I didn't know until decades later that he'd actually written the melody to Deportees. The crops are all in and the peaches are rotting. I didn't know that until there was a big Woody Guthrie festival over in Brooklyn in 2016, and I went to it, and they handed out a book. I knew so many of his songs, and I knew his life and so on, but I just didn't know that Woody didn't write that melody. I found out later a lot of songs he didn't write the melody to. He wrote the melody to This Land, certainly, and also to I woke up in a dry bed, Daddy, come see. That one he wrote his own. But there were a lot of songs he didn't write too. And his daughter, Nora, quite often would give lyrics to somebody and say, could you put this to music so we can get it recorded?
I loved your recent anthology, White Bird, which is such a fascinating project. I think it's your first time recording the It's a Beautiful Day song, White Bird, the title track.
Yes. I didn't know it. I didn't know it from Adam. And my distributor, Brian Pereiro, who has helped me get the record label out that I supervise, he brought the song to me. And he said, I think you should sing it. And I said, I think so too. But I didn't know the group. I didn't know the song or Beautiful Day. But I was telling somebody recently that I turned on one of these endless series, I think a British mystery series, the other day, and I heard it was being played in the first break. It was being played of their version, Beautiful Day's version. So I'm glad I finally caught up with it.
Oh, I love your version so much, and I love how you revisited some of your songs like Turn, 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 Chelsea Morning, and Randy Newman's I Think It's Gonna Rain Today. Oh my gosh, I mean, that song gets me every time. What is your relationship to those songs now? Has their meaning changed or evolved for you, or are those constants for you that keep you kind of anchored?
Well, when I sing them, they do the same thing for me that they always did, which is to make me happy and let me sing, you know. They let me sing. I mean, there are certain songs that really let you sing. they allow you to sing them. They're so well put together that you almost can't help but sing them. And some of these songs, like Turn, 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 are like that. I mean, they just kind of invade your mind and they make you capable of singing them.
I love the new arrangements to some of them, too. It's such a cool way. I think that it was almost like hearing them for the first time, which is really special for me as someone who's loved those songs and your music for so many years.
Good. I'm so glad you like the album. I love it, too. I loved doing it.
Here's a question, kind of a broad question. Would you consider yourself an optimist?
Oh, by God, of course I am.
Yeah?
Absolutely. My sister says that's my one defect.
Well, I know that the last 18 months have definitely been a challenging time for optimists. What's been keeping you grounded and feeling good?
Oh, lots of things. We have had a very privileged lockdown in the sense that I had not had a vacation. I had not had time off in so many years. And quite frankly, I needed it. I needed a break. And, you know, I was always told for years, why don't you get, you know, you've got to be able to take a few months off in the summer. I was never able to because, you know, you want to make a living, you have to show up, the dates are coming in, you can't. So there was no way to really do that for any length of time. I mean, maybe you'd get, I don't know, I just was not. And so when it happened, for me, it was an advantage because I got the time off. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I took a nap every day. Every day. I mean, I did anyway, because I'm in my 80s now. People do that in their 80s. They take naps. And I've taken full advantage of that privilege. But I've also continued working, and the working and the being able to sit down every day and work at the piano and work on writing and trying to write poetry and songs and so on. It's a wonderful thing to be able to do, to have some enlightening moments, and then of course to be able to unfortunately watch what is going in the world and be devastated by the deaths. I mean, I lost a couple of friends that were very close to me, and you know, that's horrible. And of course the devastation of the death count is something that takes your breath away, really. And I'll have to say a word for wearing masks and for getting vaccinated. It's essential. It's not about you. It's about everybody in your family. It's about the people you interact with. It's about your neighbors. And to think it's just about yourself is extremely short-sighted.
I'm glad you were able to get some time for yourself. I know you're doing, 150 shows a year or something like that, I think I read. It's
120, but almost 120.
That is incredible. When you write every day, is it almost like some people do yoga every day, some people jog? It's a daily practice for you to...
Oh, yeah, and I jog. I work on the treadmill. I take walks. I work on the bicycle. I try to do my stretches. Yeah, I have to. I mean, there's no way to keep up with what's going on physically unless you're exercising and eating right. I don't drink, I don't smoke, I don't scream, you know. You have to give up a lot to stay on the planet.
There was an interview you gave recently. I'm trying to remember who it was with. I read it. It might have been with AARP. And you said something that I will never forget. Somebody was asking you about retirement. You gave an amazing response. I swear I'll remember for the rest of my life. You saying that retirement was created in the Industrial Revolution.
That's right.
I wanted to ask you more about that. That's so fascinating.
It was created by management. It was created by the 1% to keep the rest of us from making money as we grow older. You know, you fire people at a certain level because if they stay longer, they're going to cost you more money. It's, you know, we throw people out of, anyway, I think retirement was invented. You know, if you're a rancher, you never retire. I suppose that's in my DNA, in my history, my farming and some degree ranching, farming. But being an artist, you never retire. I mean, why would you retire? How could you retire from doing something that had kept you alive and probably kept you from jumping off a roof? I think that being creative and being a poet or a writer or a painter or an artist of any kind, a communicator, you know, you have to keep going. Because it's part of your DNA. It's part of who you are. It's not just the product. It's the essential discipline of doing those things on a daily basis, which makes you capable of not only staying on the planet, but also contributing.
I feel like that's something that a lot of people forget these days. It becomes about the product.
Yeah, true enough.
Thank goodness we have wonderful people like you. Judy Collins, it has been a true pleasure and an honor. Thank you so much for your time today and your music. It is
a
wonderful joy. I can't wait to hear more of your show.
It's a great, great treat. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Inside the Studio, a production of iHeartRadio. For more episodes of Inside the Studio or other fantastic shows, check out the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Listen to the highly anticipated 100th episode of Tank and Jay Valentine's R&B Money Podcast with artist Chris Brown.
Even working with you from Carrie Hills and Adonis, back in the day, I was 15, 14 doing that album. So like I said, I was in school like, okay, this is how you do it. This is how you make a song. There's a verse, a pre-chorus, and then a hook. I didn't know none of that.
You learned that over a summer, bro.
That's what it felt like.
That's what it felt like.
Listen to R&B Money on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, this is Justin Richmond, host of the Broken Record Podcast. Join me along with co-host Leah Rose as we sit down with the artists you love to get unparalleled creative insight. You'll hear revealing interviews with some of the most legendary figures in music, like Paul Simon, Usher, Pete Townsend, Damon Albarn of the Gorillaz, and Missy Elliott. And you'll hear from up-and-comers like jazz artist Leve, who told me about her fast rise to fame during the pandemic. Listen to Broken Record on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Check the backseat. Check the backseat.
All right, come here.
Check the backseat.
Gets in your head, right? Good. Because every year, dozens of children are forgotten in the backseat of a car by a parent or caregiver. All never thought it could happen to them. But with changes in routines, distractions, or a sleeping child, it can happen to anyone. Parked cars get hot, fast, and can be deadly. So get it in your head.
Check the backseat.
A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.